Information of how to do all the things we're working on the outside, what most of the things people are trouble with, and we'll probably spend like half of the time next Monday talking about that.
It took a while. Included, and I reserve the right to correct it. I think I got all of that. And if you want to reference the average without late penalties was 153 out of 153 with a standard deviation of around 0.7. 25.
That's average without late penalty.
Without late
penalty. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I'm back. Today I'm going to be talking a lot more about CUDA, how do we program GPUs, and then I'm going to talk about your next homework assignment, which is going to be a CUDA programming assignment. So hopefully after this homework assignment, we have kind of two different parts. One is more substantial than the other. One is kind of more of a project style. You'll have a lot of familiarity with CUDA, and you can put "I know CUDA" on your resume and not be lying. These assignments are kind of meant to be hand-holdy, but really teach you both the architectural insights, but also kind of give you kind of a background, so that you can practically use GPUs for your research or trying to find a job. Okay, so a review of Monday. So again, introduce GPUs, these big kind of barrel vector SIMD processors or whatever we want to call them. It's hard to fit them into a box here, mainly because the vocabulary is so terrible at describing what we design. But I wanted to go back to this thing. You know, if you got anything, if you're like completely asleep or missed Monday's lecture, this is the big point. Okay? We're trying to accelerate things, and we can't accelerate things because of two different reasons. Breakdown in Dennard scaling, which is a power density problem. Okay, so power is too high per unit area. And then also the von Neumann bottleneck, which is memory accesses are really, 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 really slow. Okay, so GPUs do these things, right? We're kind of adopting some barrel processor features that we talked about to do the latency hiding, kind of tackle a lot of the issues with memory being, you know, on the moon and taking a long time to get there. And then also some of the SIMD vector architecture features. Okay, so we're doing things in parallel, we're doing this acceleration, but we're being more efficient with our program here. Okay, so hopefully you know we don't have to kind of beat this over the head, but you can use this as a reference, you know, for studying maybe for your final. So we had some questions too, and also some things I should have included on Monday that I didn't. But you know, one of the questions I don't remember, but we were kind of getting into. You know, what's going to happen to GPU architecture in the future? What is guiding GPU architecture? How are they going to co-evolve with graphics moving forward? And we've seen machine learning really drive a change in architecture over the last few years. Okay, so neural nets, turns out GPUs are really, really good for training neural nets. So good that people are starting to buy GPUs for training neural nets, and NVIDIA has dollar signs in their eyes, and all of a sudden they want to make the architecture even better, okay? So what they actually did was they're adjusting their next generation microarchitecture to support half precision floating point. Okay, so single precision is 32 bits, double precision is 64 bits. You'd think you'd want more precision, and that's what scientists were demanding, okay, to get into supercomputers. Now we want half precision, because machine learning algorithms don't really need to be that accurate. They're approximate algorithms on average. Okay. I think one more thing that might crop up in the future, but might not, is bioinformatics. Okay, so doing things like sequence alignment or de novo sequence assembly. Things like that are really important for improving cancer treatments. Okay, so there are these big problems that we care about as a society that GPUs actually might be good at. If the government is going to write the check, NVIDIA is going to change their architecture to support things like this.
Can you actually not do that stuff with normal bit slicing?
You can, but it's just inefficient. You know, do you need 64
even
bits?
Have all the bitwise operations.
Yeah, it depends on your algorithm. Yeah. So even bioinformatics is evolving at a pace where things like Hamming distance and edit distance, aren't cutting it anymore. Things like having more, maybe this has less to do with the computation side of things, but more the DRAM or the GDDR that exists on the boards. Mm-hmm. So if you're a bioinformatics researcher, you might want 256 gigabytes of onboard GDDR5, whereas nobody else would care about that.
Okay.
This is from NVIDIA marketing. I don't know why that middle one isn't green, but just more motivation. This is actually a product that NVIDIA came out with recently. It's called the DGX1. You might have seen this in like kind of popular news media about computer hardware. They call it this AI supercomputer in a box. It has something like, I think, 8 Pascal GPUs inside, or I think it's actually Maxwell right now, coupled with a couple of Xeon cores, or Xeon chips, multi-core Xeon processors. So this is essentially just like a big server rack. It costs $130,000. Okay, so that's why this is not like just for research or just to be good guys. They're trying to make money off of these things. And they're very powerful. If you wanna accelerate, you're using neural networks and you can map it to CUDA very easily, this makes sense for you to buy, because it's gonna replace, maybe a whole cluster of servers. Okay, so speaking of supercomputers, I forgot to mention that GPUs are going into supercomputers. Some of the motivation for architectural changes is from scientists. Scientists are starting to use this for weather simulations, right? These kind of scientific simulations, nuclear simulations, material science, things like that. Scientists want lots of precision. They want precision and also accuracy in their simulations. And so this motivated the inclusion of double precision compute capabilities in GPUs. Double precision support has kind of like waxed and waned over the years. Sometimes it's fast, sometimes it's slow. And it's all in response to the market. Who is buying these machines? Who is using them? And I think that's really interesting. Titan is particularly interesting because it was kind of all in on this GPU idea. Okay, so we're gonna have Xeon cores, our kind of main server processors, our i7s or whatever. But then we're going to have a one-to-one CPU to GPU correspondence in the entire system. So it's really a GPU supercomputer. We have this host, we have this device we're computing with, and that's our node. Okay. Over the years, though, Titan, I guess, came online in kind of the early teens, and was the fastest supercomputer in the world, and then was quickly overtaken by Tianhe 2 in China. At least as far as theoretical peak goes. Tianhe 2 was a Xeon Phi design, which is kind of a many in order core design coprocessor, so completely different style of computation, although there are SIMD units in that coprocessor. This is a new computer that came online this summer in China as well, that has a completely home-designed microprocessor, which is super interesting. So if you guys are interested, you can go check that out. One thing I want to highlight here, like why are we talking about supercomputers all of a sudden, is this metric. Okay, so here we have HPL, which stands for LINPACK. LINPACK is an HPC benchmark, what we commonly use to kind of just measure essentially how fast supercomputers are, how effective they are. And what this is this is the performance as a percentage of the peak performance. So this is like how many, depending on how many ALUs I have in the whole system, like how many, how many flops I can do. Okay, and then this is actually achieved. So this is essentially measuring utilization, which is kind of a combined metric of like how easy it is to program, right, and how well designed your system is, and then how does that system map onto the problem you're trying to solve, which is LINPACK. Okay, so we only have one benchmark. And it's pretty interesting that even though Tianhe 2 has a higher peak performance, right, its utilization is lower. So maybe it was under-designed. Okay. On the contrary, right, the Taihu Lite has much, much higher. It's a better design system for this LINPACK benchmark.
And so something to note is that you see that those numbers are less than 70%. And LINPACK is like the best case for getting those numbers
right.
High.
Yeah.
Not only is it a relatively easy problem to use a lot of arithmetic units for, but it's one that a lot of people spend a lot of time optimizing very carefully. It's the sort of thing that our paper we go to was about a subpart of that. Like, people spend a lot of time on that. So if you think of normal problems, they're not going to be as good.
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, maybe one of the reasons why Oak Ridge has, a higher percentage of peak than Tianhe 2 is that just this system has been around for a lot longer. So maybe we have more resources devoted to optimizing that code. It might not be just easier. We have no control in this experiment. So Jack Dongara, who kind of is like a, actually invented LINPACK, he has come up with a few new benchmarks to try and kind of sort out this cherry picking for LINPACK, right? And one of them is this HPCG benchmark, which I didn't read too much into, but essentially it was, trying to represent a more realistic use case, more realistic memory access patterns, more realistic computation as our supercomputing needs have evolved over the years. And you can see these numbers have all of a sudden tanked, okay? This is what I have heard from these supercomputing experts at kind of Titan, Sandia, Los Alamos. They're all quoting numbers like this. We only have about 3% utilization, and we're extremely frustrated by it, when we actually run applications on these devices. That's insane, okay? We're sitting here in like grad architecture talking about all of these architectures and how awesome they are. And out in the real world, we only have 3% utilization. That's silly. There's a huge, there's 99% room for optimization there. It's pretty embarrassing. And a lot of it has to do with memory, right? The von Neumann bottleneck is really kind of kicking us in our butts. So anyway, I also think it's interesting how these kind of like, all of a sudden Titan wins, at this kind of different application space. It's all of a sudden like the best utilized, not by much, right? Everybody sucks. But that might be an indication that the programming model is a little easier or maps better onto that particular architecture. And that's why I brought this up. Because this might have to do with CUDA, okay? So, yeah, I was just trying to highlight those. Okay, so now to today's lecture. We're gonna talk about how do you program SIMD computers. Okay, so you guys have talked about Cray. We've, talked about GPU. And I'm gonna introduce first vMIPS, which is actually out of your textbook, and then also why it's obnoxious. And then introduce this new programming style called SIMT, single instruction multiple thread computing. So single instruction multiple data computing, which is what CUDA and OpenCL are. Then we're going to do CUDA programming model, some kind of intricacies of the CUDA programming model, like how do we handle branching, synchronization, things like that, go over some example code. And then I'm going to transition to the assignment. I'm going to walk you through kind of the first part of the assignment, setting things up, looking at the code, launching jobs on the department cluster, and things like that. Okay.
So if we're talking about vMIPS, it's worth noting that this is almost like SSE or
mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So it's actually more practical than it seems like.
Yeah.
Given that we're talking about an imaginary architecture.
So this is an imaginary architecture kind of out of your out of your textbook. Yeah, so we have our vector registers, right? We're loading vectors from memory, great. We're doing kind of all this, taking advantage of programmed in locality and things like that, and instruction fetch, blah, blah, blah. And then we have all our vector units, whatever, and then we have some scalar operations too that we can do. Scalar registers, so if we wanted to do like a DAXP or something, we could do this. So let's look at some code. Okay, why are we going to do VMIPS in, or vector processing, period? Okay, so this is what's called a DAXP computation. Okay, so we have these, these two giant vectors, x and y, okay, and then for each location in x and y in these large vectors or arrays, we're going to multiply x by a scalar, and we're going to add it to whatever's in that location of y. Okay, pretty simple computation, but this shows up a lot in scientific computations. It's part of LIMPAC. These are the types of things that we actually care about accelerating. And here we have this bound, right? So we're going to kind of do this 64 times in a loop, and this is how you just naively write this. Of course, this is embarrassingly parallel. Okay, there are no inter-loop iteration dependencies here. So we can spread this across any arbitrary amount of cores. We can do this using a vector computer. So this is actually kind of the compiled version of the sequential program, right? We're going to compile it down to this kind of MIPS program, so you can see, okay, we're like loading the scalar. And then we enter into our loop, and then we're loading this x, right? Then we're doing our multiplication by our scalar, loading the location y, doing the final computation, storing it to y, and then we kind of have all this computation to, handle our loop bound and kind of branch up to the loop or check our loop bound. Okay, and we're going to do this 64 times based on my previous code. And here's the VMIPS code, assuming we have a 64-wide vector unit, right? We're going to load the scalar and then load the vector from memory. Okay. Then we're going to do the scalar multiply. We're going to multiply a by x. And then we're going to load y. And then we're going to do the add and store the result. Right? We're doing everything as a big long vector. Okay. So one of the things we didn't talk about before, I mean, you guys talked about this with the Cray, but like loop unrolling, right, is advantageous because you're getting rid of a lot of these instructions that have to deal with kind of the control flow. So you're reducing opportunities for mispredictions, although normally these loops are very easy to predict because you just go over and over and over again. But you're also getting rid of those instructions, which are a significant amount in this style of computation. Okay, so vector computation is good. We just wrote a vector program. Why don't we do this all the time? Has anybody in here written an explicit vector program in C? Oh, you guys did do it.
Well, not in this class.
Oh, okay.
In class,
okay.
Undergrad class?
Has anybody done it like for a job or for practical reasons? No? Okay. Charles, okay. Sure. I haven't ever. I did it. I did a couple research exercises once to try to accelerate a C program, but there are a few different reasons that I came up with for why we don't do vector computation. And Charles, because you have practical experience, I'd like to hear more about your motivation for why you even considered doing that. But
and dealt with some code which was...
We need to hyper-optimize.
...code that was where there was a SIMD version for that.
There we go. Okay.
It was index processing code.
And it was,
so it was
a bottleneck. There,
bottleneck,
sure.
But
so
I've done it for 5.
Yeah.
Class,
and it's a pain. It's a pain to do by hand. I mean, we think sequentially. Okay, that's why even multi-programming is difficult. Okay, we think sequentially. This is why your programming assignment is going to be difficult.
and I guess something to keep in mind, which is probably one of the bigger problems of difficulty, is that when we looked at the Cray, they had these features like a vector and strides for loading. When we're talking about AVX and SSE, which are the support for this sort of thing on like my laptop, those features don't exist. Mm-hmm. You have to, if things don't fit in the 8Y vectors for AVX, you need to write code which handles it with only 8Y vector operations. Like, that's a whole lot of extra code.
And you get it wrong.
Stride, you need to write code to load multiple things and then shuffle things around in your vector register.
Yeah. And so that's kind of point number two. It's just really hard. OK? Okay. And you only ever do it if you have identified, you know, you're at Facebook and you say, okay, oh my gosh, our clicks are taking 100 milliseconds. And I figured out that 50 of those milliseconds could be optimized down to 4 if I SIMD vectorize this, you know, this code. I'm going to go in and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, explicit vectorization is hard. You can auto-vectorize code, right? You could think, you're like, wow, this is very mathematical, right? I can, if I know my loop bounds and I know all the data I'm working with, I can kind of automatically, I can just write an algorithm to do this for us. And there's been mixed success. It really depends on your code. It depends on the algorithms. That also is hard because it does, most of the time, require some explicit tagging, which I have a few slides on that. Also, hardware, I mean, used to be expensive. Okay, this is a pretty weak argument. Okay, but in order to program in a Cray 1, right, you had to have a Cray 1, and those cost millions of dollars. So we just didn't grow up in an environment where everybody had a vector computer. That's changed, right? Everybody now has GPUs. Right? AVX instructions are essentially ubiquitous in laptop computers, but normally we just don't need them. Okay, so nobody has exposure to them. And also, you know, things like these, you know, AVX instructions, they used to not be very wide when I first started giving this lecture, and now like the widest one is 512 bits, which is actually very wide. You know, that's like as wide as all the SIMD units on the GPU. So that this is becoming kind of less of an argument. You know, CPUs are kind of catching up with the SIMD widths. They don't have as many cores, right? But they're at least offering that style of width. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about vectorizable code. Okay, so I have a kind of just a function foo here, okay? And I'm gonna iterate, okay, and add these two values in a vector together over, you know, the length of the vector is 256. I'm gonna store it in the third vector. Okay? And all of these are kind of, you know, globally defined. The compiler can see the number 256. It can see that 256 is here. It can see that 256 is here. It can do the math and figure out, oh, well, I can unroll this by maybe 4, 8, or 16 and actually do this computation in parallel. Emit code for you, handle all the issues, and then you get the acceleration for free. That's great. Okay, now I'm going to change this code a little bit. Okay. So now instead of having these kind of like, you know, well-defined lengths and global variables, now I'm passing in pointers to these structures, and then also a length that's a variable of those structures. Okay, now this problem becomes unvectorizable. Okay, you can do, you know, you can throw a lot of techniques at this, but it's the mathematics to figure out, you know, what elements are actually being referenced here can be impossible. Okay, so statically, we actually can't identify that it's always safe to do this computation. Okay. Now we can do things like pragmas. Okay, I don't know if anybody has ever been exposed to pragmas, but some programming languages and compilers allow you to kind of annotate your code and give the compiler hints and say, no, it is safe to do this, or you should take a second look at this loop, or just unroll it anyway. I know it's unsafe, but I'm never going to use it in the unsafe way. So things like this will pop up. If you ever see this in code, don't be scared. It's just, you know, a try. You know, we're kind of throwing things at the wall to see how we can make our code faster and vectorizable. Okay, and then we can also do things like, you know, if you have expert knowledge of C and you know, oh, it can't, you know, auto vectorize this code or unroll these loops because it can't disambiguate these pointers. You can kind of say, oh, I know that these pointers will always not overlap, and so you can go ahead and do this less conservative, evaluation or pass of this code and analysis of this code, and it'll go ahead and vectorize it anyway. But all this is still, you know, this is automatic vectorization, and it doesn't seem very automatic, right? We're still kind of really jumping through hoops.
So hypothetically, the compiler could check the overlap for you. And if you look at real compilers, once in a blue moon will do that.
Yeah.
But usually not.
Okay, so the solution here, at least for GPUs, NVIDIA kind of had this problem, right? They have these great GPUs, and they know that all these researchers have been using, kind of forcing these computations through the graphics pipeline in order to do general purpose computation. You know, how do we make this easier? How do we make massively parallel programming easier. And so they came up with SIMT programming, single instruction, multiple thread. Okay. And this is kind of, you know, when you hear CUDA or OpenCL, these are SIMT programming models. And the idea here is instead of thinking about one thread that operates on vector data, you think about every piece of data having an individual thread. Break your contract with the hardware and kind of reimagine how your program is running on the architecture. But ultimately you're going to win. You're going to gain a lot out of making that leap, okay, to a different programming style. Okay, so we're going to talk about CUDA. CUDA and OpenCL are basically identical. The differences are academic at this point. CUDA is a hierarchical thread programming model. Okay, so we're always going to be thinking about threads. We're not going to be thinking about data. Okay. And it's going to combine kind of these MIMD ideas, maybe like the barrel processor ideas, okay, with the SIMD ideas, the vector ALUs under the hood, to make it easier to program. And this maps really well to GPU architectures, right? That's what we have under the hood, is this weird Frankenstein architecture. Okay. So first, at a very, very high level, this is true for all accelerator programming today. Okay. You have some sort of host. We're going to assume a CPU. We have a CPU, it's running Linux, it's running some sort of program, right? And then we want to have a piece of code called a kernel that we want to accelerate on a device. Okay, so some sort of GPU. So all accelerator programming, at least right now, is I'm going to run my computation. Oh, I entered it into a piece of code I want to launch on the GPU. I'm going to reserve data over on the GPU, or do a malloc on the GPU, so reserve space. I'm going to transfer the data over to the GPU, okay? Then I'm going to do my computation on the GPU, and then I'm going to transfer the results back to the CPU. So this is kind of host device. We have this communication going on. Currently, this generally happens over the PCI Express bus. That's how we're going to be using the device. But obviously, you have like APUs and things like that, kind of heterogeneous architectures, where you can do this in you can do this piece kind of in a faster way if you compromise some of the compute capabilities of the device. Okay, so host device, get that kind of vocabulary in your head. The CUDA thread model, like I mentioned, is single instruction, multiple thread. And how we're going to program these things is we're going to take a thread, a large group of threads, which we call a grid, and we're going to map each thread to a part of some domain or some sort of input. So take, for example, our vector add, right? Our input is kind of two very long vectors, okay? They have some sort of length. And we're going to map maybe one thread to one add between those two vectors, or one thread to 256 adds, or something like that. It's kind of up to us how we map our threads to this input domain. Each thread is going to execute that kernel function that I talked about earlier. So some sort of program, it's going to wake up and be like, okay, I'm thread 1024, and now I'm going to execute this program and then go right back to sleep. This is a hierarchical thread programming model. Okay, so threads here are grouped into blocks. Think of this as, one thread is like a soldier. There's platoons, right? There's kind of this hierarchy of how we can kind of treat programming and threads on the device. And then blocks are further divided into vector groups or warps. So if you have a platoon, maybe you have a subdivision that then is going to be executed on a SIMD unit. Don't worry, there will be a picture. And then threads distinguish computation by querying these internal IDs. So in CUDA, when a thread wakes up, every thread is going to run the same kernel function. So in order to distinguish computation among threads, you have to use these IDs, these coordinates, in order to guide the thread to different parts of your domain. Okay, that's how you're going to do the mapping. Okay, so here's a picture. Okay, so over here we have our architecture, right? And you can kind of see our SMs stamped out here that correspond to these kind of big, block diagrams, right? Here's our grid. Okay. And then within our grid, we have all of our threads, and then each thread is divided into blocks. Right? Okay, so these are kind of our platoons. And imagine that each one of these blocks can be just kind of doled out to any one of these SMs on the architecture, okay? So you can use any algorithm to dole them all out. They can go out in any order. They are kind of standalone programs. Now, threads within a block might communicate with each other, okay? But otherwise, you have no guarantee of the ordering of this execution. So threads are going to, these blocks, these individual blocks are going to be mapped onto these SMs. Okay, now I mentioned a warp earlier. This is the real magic of SIMT, is that you have your block, you have your platoon, but every 32 in this architecture, consecutive threads, is going to be under the hood mapped to a SIMD operation. So a warp is essentially 32 threads that are chain gang together and execute as a SIMD, single SIMD instruction. That's the bait and switch they're doing with SIMT. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about that? That's like the magic here. So you can see that our group is larger than the SIMD width. Okay. But now we can take this, okay, because they're all executing the same kernel function, we can execute this on a SIMD ALU. Okay, we can execute every instruction that all of these threads are going to execute the same instruction at the same time because they are only one instruction. And that's what a warp is. You can think of warps as just instruction streams. Okay. So this blue box here, it's not going to be individual threads that you're scheduling on different cores, right? They're going to be, this is all abstracted away and is a SIMD instruction and gets run through your vector unit. However that's designed. Okay. So first of all, any questions about that? It'll become kind of clearer as you gain a little more experience with this, but I always kind of go back to this, you know, it's a hierarchy, right? You have all of your threads organized into blocks. Blocks can go anywhere within a block. Each number of threads is divided up into a warp, and those warps are what get executed on the hardware.
How are the SMs? So what's the hierarchy of the very confidence?
Grid is all of your threads, and how you define a grid is you tell it, I want X number of blocks with and the thread organization within a block. These can be two-dimensional, but the programming assignment is just one-dimensional. Why?
Are the SMs associated with blocks?
Yes. So you have your GPU over here, you have your hardware SMs, right? And the command processor in the GPU gets a kernel call and it says, okay, I have this many blocks, and just starts kind of round-robining. I actually don't know what NVIDIA uses, but AMD uses round-robin. I actually don't know that, but for newer hardware, but there's no real reason because of your latency hiding to use anything else. But yeah, so you can think about the command processor saying, whoa, I got this kernel call. Blocks go everywhere. And anywhere. You could have one SM, right? You could have one kind of core here and just hand out blocks to that core. Multiple blocks can be launched to a single SM. Okay, we don't care. But yeah, so hopefully that kind of sinks in. Again, it doesn't have to sink in now. You can go back to this for reference. Google. Get that in your head, that kind of thread hierarchy, to be able to think about it. Note that under the warp is something that exists under the hood, so you'll never explicitly be able to know what thread is in what warp. Okay, that's something that's taken in, that's done by the hardware. But for performance reasons, it's really, 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 really important to know that all of your threads are being mapped to these kind of SIMD instructions under the hood. It's the magic of being a good GPU programmer, is you have this kind of, you know, architecture intuition and also, you know, good programming skills. Okay, so just a little bit of history too. Kevin always loves to tell this story, but he was on sabbatical at NVIDIA, and he was kind of essentially in the room when they were coming up with CUDA, okay, figuring out how we're going to do this, how we're going to present this to the outside world. So he can be credited a very small portion of kind of co-writing CUDA or co-defining CUDA. And you know, I always ask him, you know, one of the first things that people kind of ask when they learn about CUDA is, why SIMD? SIMD sounds so dumb. Why it's SIMD? Why do we have to come up with this whole new term? And I asked him to kind of write a little response to this. So apologies for all the text, but kind of the bold stuff is the important stuff. So I asked him, well, you know, what were you trying to do? You know, why did you have to come up with a whole new term? And he says, we were trying to figure out how to describe the SM execution model, which is SIMD, but not vector. I was like, okay, well, you know, vector is SIMD. And then he goes on to kind of elaborate. He says, well, However, many people today don't appreciate that SIMD doesn't equal vector. Vector is a subset of SIMD, technically, blah, blah, blah. These words just aren't good enough to describe the style of computation we're doing. That's his point here. This is a further complication was that there were two levels of parallelism. Okay? The warp level SIMD parallelism, okay? So again, you have these kind of chain gang threads that are being mapped to really data locations in a SIMD ALU. Okay? But then you also have this kind of thread block level parallelism, where the blocks are being doled out to this larger architecture. And that's the barrel processor style. Okay, so there are these two kind of competing, you know, architecture styles of parallelism here that are fight, you know, our vocabulary is really is struggling to describe this architecture and even how to program it. Okay. So essentially this guy, John Nichols, who was a big NVIDIA bigwig, came up with this term, and everybody was like, well, that kind of sucks, but it's really the best that we could come up with. So, anyway, I just think this is just really interesting because he, you know, lives right upstairs. You can see Kevin's name kind of on the first kind of ACMQ article about CUDA. This is kind of the world introduction to CUDA, so pretty fun. Okay, back to CUDA. So we have this CUDA thread programming model. Grids are made up of blocks, are made up of threads. Blocks get scheduled to these SMs, okay? They can get scheduled to any SM on the device. Every single block, every 32 threads within a block is divided up into a warp, which is, think about it as a single SIMD instruction stream. Okay, so that's what's gonna be executed under the hood in your vector ALUs or SIMD ALUs. Okay, let's talk about the memory model. Okay, so we have our GPUs, right? We have kind of our global memory, right? And we have some semblance of cache, right? GPUs also give you this scratchpad memory, okay? So scratchpad memory, think about it as cache, but it's software managed, okay? Normally cache, you don't ever think about it, right? The hardware takes care of that for you, right? Exploiting things like data, spatial locality and temporal locality, okay? Now, the GPU is going to rip out all of our caches, right? Because we're latency tolerant. But it's going to give you the shared memory so that if you know stuff about how, you know, data access patterns and you kind of know how your computation is going to behave, you can take advantage of some of the benefits of caching. But you have to program that into your kernel. All threads are able to access the kind of global memory, right? You're going to send over the GPU these arrays, and every thread can index into these arrays. So it's kind of this shared address space. Only threads within a block can see shared memory. And one of the main reasons for that is because if shared memory is here, and one block is scheduled here, and another block is scheduled here, and shared memory is here, we're going to just kind of, you know, those memories are isolated, right? They don't share the same, you know, the same address bus. And so we're not going to jump through hoops to let different blocks share those data structures, right? We're talking about parallelism, right? Everything is hierarchical. So we're going to kind of restrict access at that point for varying different reasons. And obviously threads have their own registers. And we call this kind of private memory. Okay. Under the hood, each thread might have a particular register, like a 32-bit int. But remember, the warp is how it's actually executed. So every 32-bit register is really a vector register of the corresponding warp. Okay. Something, you know, you guys should have been exposed to this in prior classes, but memory consistency. I don't know if you guys remember, you know, beaten over the head with memory consistency. It's extremely boring, but anyway, the idea on the GPU, right, in order to hide latency, we're not going to guarantee anything. This is a part of breaking the contract. So whereas CPU, we have this idea of kind of at least a single processor, sequential consistency, right? We're going to kind of execute this program stream and things are going to happen in order. Here we have lots of parallel things going on at the same time, and so we're going to just throw that idea of order out the window. You have no guarantees about ordering, or you know, some guarantees about ordering, but they're very relaxed. Okay, but we're going to give you these special instructions to insert in your program to kind of enforce consistency when you really need it. So here's a picture of the memory model. Right, we have threads. Okay, these threads are in maybe one block. Okay, so thread 0 of block 0, thread 1 of block 0. These threads have access to their own private registers, and they also have access to this shared memory. Okay, so they can kind of load into this cache kind of, you know, data that they're going to share amongst each other. Okay, and then everybody has access to this global address space. Make sense? It's not super complex. Okay, so let's get into some code examples. This is actually from that ACMQ article that I showed you. So this is kind of like the front-facing first way to build a CUDA program. Hopefully you guys can see this. I apologize if it's kind of small. But here's our Saxby. So this is a single precision AX plus B. This is what we saw earlier. Okay, so we're running through this for loop up to N, and then we're just going to do that computation, right? Scalar times the vector plus added to the vector. Okay, and then this is how we invoke that kernel. This is what we're calling the kernel. The kernel of code. So we're just making that function call. Okay. Here's how we're going to define our CUDA kernel. So we're going to use this kind of global tag. Whenever you see this, you know, okay, I see it. I'm seeing a GPU program. Okay. And it looks the same, right? We kind of have the same kind of declaration, or it looks basically identical. Okay. But the first thing we do is we're querying these special constants, which are our coordinates. So again, imagine you enter into this function, you're a thread, and you kind of like wake up. You have to ask, who am I? You know, am I thread 0, am I thread 1, am I thread 1024? And that's what it's calculating here. It's calculating kind of this linear ID, this global ID. Once you know that ID, you know your mapping. You know where to go in this vector to do this computation and where to store the result. Okay. They're doing something interesting here too, where if your ID is greater than n, don't do any computation. Okay, don't do anything. So that means if you put in an n, if we launch enough threads, right? Charles was talking about this earlier, kind of this striding or alignment. We have to fit all of our threads into 32 wide warps or 32 wide SIMD instructions. So you can see here, there's some way that the hardware has to figure out how to turn threads on and off. So this is kind of very clever. This is very easy to write. Much, much, much easier than explicit vector code. Okay, here's another example. This is one that I kind of wrote up. It's a little easy, you know, it's a little simpler. Okay, so we're just adding two vectors together. So first what we're going to do is we're going to take the block dimension in the x direction. Okay, so that's the size. And then we're going to multiply it by how big the block index, okay, so which block we are. So this is going to get kind of an offset, okay, this is a block offset. Then we're going to get the local ID of that thread within that block, okay, so if you're in platoon 4, I'm soldier 16, okay, then you're going to take 4 times the size of the platoons plus your you know, soldier ID, and then we're going to get our total offset by adding those two together. So you're going to get this kind of global ID number. Then based on that global ID number, we're going to do this mapping. So again, that's what I mean when I say we're mapping threads into the domain. It's up to you to figure out what one thread is responsible for, and also at the same time, what each block is responsible for. You kind of have this like dual role of coordinating threads and block computation. Okay. So now I'm going to kind of throw a wrench into things, which it's going to be easier for you guys to answer this if you were paying attention like last week. Okay. But we've been talking about warps, SIMD computation, all the threads doing the exact same computation. They have to. They all share the same instruction. So what happens if I ask every even thread to do a computation and every odd thread to sit out? How do we handle this? Okay, that doesn't seem possible, right? Because if we have SIMD computation, we have 32 threads, and they all share the same instruction. They all have to execute that same instruction. So we can't branch, right? So how do we solve this? We've actually already seen a solution. Does anybody remember?
Go for it.
So you're talking about manually partitioning it?
Well,
maybe redoing your mapping?
Yeah, the mapping, not actual.
Sure.
Or you could actually move the memory around.
Sure. You could absolutely do that. What if you can't do that?
You can do the math and figure out if you're even better than it's not right to.
Sure. Yeah, just skip. Right, so if we know, we're obviously doing this kind of branch computation beforehand, okay? So what the hardware is going to do is it's going to keep track of this special long vector, okay? And based on the computation of every single thread, okay, if we have a branch, the thread is going to say, oh, I'm active here and I'm not active here. Or you know, I'm active for this line of code. I am actually executing that code. That's exactly right. We call this predication. And this is kind of just like a fancy crap term for, you know, to reference predicates or, you know, Booleans, right? True or false. Okay, am I executing or am I not? I'm gonna predicate every single thread when I get to a branch. I like masking, you know, execution masking. We have some sort of mask register, okay, where we're gonna mask threads out of execution and execute others. That's the same slide. Okay, so this is kind of what this looks like in a picture form. So we have our warp, right? This is all of our threads, okay? But this is really just pieces of data executing an instruction stream, okay? And then we execute a branch, okay? And then there's some sort of explosion that happens, and then our threads within our warp diverge, okay? So some threads take one branch, and other threads take another branch. Okay, and then we're going to set our mask register, and we're going to execute all of the code in path A for these threads. And then we're going to invert our mask register and execute all the code in path B for these threads. And then we're going to converge again, because there's a divergence in the convergence. What makes you sad about this? Why is this bad?
It doesn't seem to do path A and path B at the same time.
Yes. We have to do both sides of the branch, okay? So if this costs 100, if this costs 1, 1, 100, 101, okay? Now we're paying a cost of 203, you know, whatever, coins, okay? Whereas a CPU, if it did this, would only ever have to pay the cost of 100. Now the CPU isn't doing parallel computation, but it's able to do this branching. So it doesn't have to always execute both of those. That's really painful. It can be really painful. It depends on your computation here. But we call this warp divergence, okay, right? We're diverging. Our SIMD instruction just can't handle this divergence. And we're going to take a 50% performance hit here if these are the same costs. That's really, really bad. So part of the assignment is going to be you guys kind of optimizing this code, first designing it in a silly way, a bad way, and then optimizing it to reduce divergence, okay? So don't over-optimize, because you have to do it the bad way in order to complete part three. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the synchronization model, too. Okay, so remember we talked about, right, blocks, warps, they can execute, and then any SM, right? So communication between blocks is difficult. Synchronizing different blocks is difficult. Synchronizing threads within a particular block is difficult. So let's say thread 0 wants to read a value that thread 64 wrote to their shared memory. How do you guarantee that that value is in the shared memory by the time thread 0 wants to pick it up? Because it's a kind of classic multi-programming synchronization problem. Because we have this barrel processor and we're just flinging instructions all over the architecture, we have no control over sequential execution across warps. Okay, so CUDA kind of gives us these classic memory fences. This is a classic memory fence. This is like the strongest fence you can possibly imagine. Whenever you execute this instruction, the semantics are, I'm going to sit and wait here until all other threads execute this instruction. Then I can proceed. So you're essentially forcing everybody to, nope, stop, don't run ahead. We all want to make sure that we can provably gotten to this point in computation before we start again.
This is what we've seen called a barrier in some papers.
Yes, yeah. In fact, they're called barriers in OpenCL, or you know, one of these is called a barrier. Okay, so how are we going to use, now that we have kind of synchronization out of the way, I want to talk a little bit about using shared memory. This is problem two in the assignment. Okay. So again, shared memory is kind of this managed cache. We're going to kick cache out because cache is expensive and we don't want to deal with the hardware, right? We're hiding latency with all of our throughput. But you always have, you know, locality that you can take advantage of. So we want to at least give people the option of taking advantage of this. Okay, if you can do it efficiently. So here we're going to sum all the values in array. So instead of mapping a single thread to a single location, we have to kind of do this type of reduction, right? We have to essentially kind of have all the threads look at all their values and then neighboring values and then kind of whittle down the computation. So here, this is kind of the naive CPU way of doing it, right? We have some sort of, you know, bound here, and we're going to just add all the numbers up in our array. Okay. So this is what the reduction is going to look like. First of all, we're going to start in global memory, right? We're going to kind of, remember, we're kind of mallocing on the GPU, sending our data over, and then turning our kernel on the GPU. And all of that data is going to be sitting in the global memory. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a single thread here in order to do this computation. Okay. A single thread is going to wake up and march through that for loop. Okay. So we're using an entire SIMD instruction, but we're masking off 31 out of the 32 threads, and we're just going to kind of march through a loop and add all of these up. Okay. So these are locations in an array. We're going to go out to memory and make these accesses. Okay. And sum them into our private register. Then we're going to store that out into our result. Okay. So how would we parallelize this? How do we make this faster? I'm gonna, you know, there are a few different ways to do this, and you guys will explore them in the programming assignment. But one thing we can do, firstly, so this is the cost, you know, it's kind of the estimated cost, excuse me. But for each one of these operations, right, each one of these memory fetches, we're gonna multiply it by some constant that's very expensive, right? This is the von Neumann bottleneck, right? Memory is essentially like on the moon, okay? We have to go a long way to get any data. And we have to pay that cost each time we do that access, naively. So one way of getting around this is we can use shared memory, okay? So what we're gonna do is instead of doing sequential accesses to global memory, we're gonna do a parallel access. So we're going to load a vector from memory. We're going to have each one of our threads in our block load from a different location into a location in the shared memory, our fast scratch pad cache. Then we're going to apply our naive algorithm here. Okay, so this one thread is still going to zip through in a dumb way all of these accesses, and store out. But now, our cost is going to be 1 times expensive plus n times cheap. Okay, so we're going to save because now we've told everybody to go to the grocery store and bring back all their fruit and put it in the refrigerator, and then I'm going to cook a meal out of the refrigerator instead of going to the grocery store for every single ingredient sequentially. Okay, that's the kind of intuition here. Okay. Now there's a problem here, and that is, how do we know when everybody's put their fruit in the refrigerator? Right? We don't want to start cooking if we don't have, you know, the data, okay? And so that's why there's a barrier here. Okay, so this barrier is kind of saying, look, everybody come back, including me, right? I'm going to go out to the grocery store, I'm going to get an orange, I'm going to come back and put it in the refrigerator, and everybody's going to wait until we're all back in the kitchen before I start cooking. That's what the thread fence does. Otherwise, if we finish first and we keep computing, right, we might miss values, okay? Other threads, other warps might have gotten stalled, might have been left behind, and we might not have the proper data there. Okay. So this is what this looks like in CUDA code. So again, we're kind of doing this sum over an array, and we're doing a reduction here. Okay. So you can see I'm allocating this shared memory. So this is going to be kind of my fast scratch pad. And then all I have to do that parallel load is tell my thread, right? I'm waking up, I'm thread ID, is load from the global in array into a corresponding location in the fast scratch pad. Then we're gonna do a sync, okay? It's kind of ambiguous which one, I think they probably have the same semantics here, but we're gonna do a sync or a thread fence, a barrier, And then we're going to have one thread do the computation. So if we're thread ID 0, do this kind of for loop and look through our fast cache and do the sum. Otherwise, just sleep. You're done. You already did your load. Okay. You guys have any questions? Okay, so this looks very, very similar to the assignment code. This is kind of, you know, the kind of dumb, naive way where we have a single thread iterating sequentially through an array. Go ahead.
Can you declare thread local arrays? Is it smart enough? So you only have registers.
Yes, you can.
So it's smart enough to map that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want them to be too large, though. And they can't be shared among threads. Okay, let's take a little bit of a break before I go into like the actual assignment code. Another quiz. I like space. This is another space quiz. Does anybody know the answer? Any guesses?
One.
One. Okay. Wrong.
Less than 10.
One is close. It's two. It's actually two. So these are the two that we have on Mars right now. These are the functional robots. We actually have 14 that are on the surface, which is, I think, is pretty interesting. So a lot of it is just space garbage. But this is Opportunity. One of the fun facts about Opportunity is that it's been going for 13 years. That's insane. That's a little over-engineering, I think, on the part of JPL. But Curiosity is also still going strong. Curiosity has kind of like a built-in timeline because it uses a thermoelectric generator, kind of like a radioactive power source, so it's going to run out. This uses solar panels and periodically gets dusted by little Mars tornadoes, so it actually can just kind of keep running. The European Space Agency and Roscosmos tried to land something on Mars 2 weeks ago, and it crashed. So that would have been our third, but it didn't happen. Okay, so now we're moving from robots to satellites. How many satellites? Functional, working. It's greater than 2. It's actually 6. Yeah, and these have kind of been around for a long time too, you know, like 14 years or 15 years. That's insane. I used to do some GPU reliability research. And this is kind of one of the reasons why you care about reliability, because you're up in space, you're in a high radiation environment, right? So you can have cosmic rays come down and start flipping bits in your computer. So it's just remarkable that these computers have been designed, over-designed for high radiation environments, and they've been able to last this long. This is actually a picture of Curiosity, which was on the last stage in its descent stage, taken from MRO, which is pretty cool. Okay, so now let's go over homework 3. We have like 15 minutes left, and I don't know if I'll take that long. But homework 3, as well as these slides, are going to be on my website. Charles can send out a link to that or send out the assignment.
From the schedule page, like other slides.
Yeah. I keep the assignment in a Google Doc, so just so I can kind of periodically update it. So once you have that Google Doc and also the code base in GitHub, that's kind of all you need. You don't need my website, but these slides will be up there. The assignment is divided into two parts. Okay, so the first part is like intro to CUDA, right? I'm going to walk you through all those optimizations. You're going to figure out how to launch multiple kernels. You're going to figure out how to optimize using shared memory, just like I described. Okay, so it's not going to be that tricky. It's not going to be that much different from these slides. You're welcome to use these slides as reference. And then we're going to get into some sort of kind of divergence optimization. Okay, so you're going to write this style of reduction in an inefficient way with the worst case thread divergence, and then rewrite it with best case thread divergence, and then you're going to compare the performance of each one of those iterations. So we're going to go from naive, shared memory optimized, reduction improvement, and then optimized reduction to reduce thread divergence. So that's part one. Normally I give that assignment and it takes people about a week. That's a week of like, you know, kind of focused effort, or a week with like a deadline at the end of the week, so people always get it done. People have never had a problem with this. I really recommend doing that in a week. You know, set your own personal deadline, get it done in a week.
We'll probably have a deadline more than a week to submit it. We aren't like, and the grading for we'll do is probably just going to be is it there?
Yeah, sure.
First, and we'll break the whole thing.
Sure, I'm fine with that. You know, we will kind of work out what this deadline looks like, but I'm imagining it being kind of like soft deadline. But definitely get a head start on this, okay? Work this out, because this part is going to be longer. This part actually might be simpler, it might be less code. You might think it's easier, but it's much more open-ended, which leaves a lot of room to mess up and waste time. So this is kind of the hand-holdy, like walkthrough, intro to CUDA, you know, beginner optimization, and then this is come up with your own project, okay? So we have a list of three projects that you can pick from that I don't have nice slides. But you can either implement these kernels and write your own CUDA kernel and application, or you can pick your own. And if you're kind of inspired based on your research or you just think these problems are boring, you can kind of pick your own, write your own kernel. But definitely make sure you talk to Charles before you run off and do that. Just want to make sure it's hard enough.
Or at least some of the ones that we're supposed to provide a serial implementation.
Yes.
And code will make sure your answer is correct. If you do your own or one which doesn't have code, make sure the answer is correct. You better write that code, because if you're not computing the right thing, it doesn't matter how fast it is.
And also, we can't promise that we will use the same program to check your code that you are using to check your code. So you can't just code to the tests and make it work, especially for this one. I've given this enough times that I know like kind of the tricky off by one errors. So okay, so let's kind of just go through a little bit of an example here, okay? So we're gonna be using GPUs. The GPUs exist on the department cluster. So in order to do this, you're gonna have to learn cluster programming. It sounds really scary, it's not that scary. I have a lot of example code for you to use. And the department does as well. Okay. So I'm on Parker's MacBook. Thank you, Parker. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to log into one of the department cluster head nodes. Okay, so how cluster computing works generally is you have some kind of development nodes that you sit on, you write your programs, and then you launch them off to kind of the bigger cluster, the worker nodes. Okay, so power 1 through 6, I think, 1 through 5, at least 1 through 5, are the kind of departments worker nodes. Yeah, not accidentally put my password on the screen, great. Okay, so now we're in. Okay, so now I'm gonna go to the assignment here, which I see a lot of you are logged into, great. I have the GitHub repo for the assignment over here, okay? So I'm gonna teach you guys a little bit of Git too. I'm just gonna click on this because that's Charles's. Okay, so this is kind of my GitHub account, right? And this is what a GitHub repo is. Maybe you guys have not seen this before, but most people have. And how we're gonna download this code is we're gonna go over to this green button, clone or download, and it's gonna have a link. And we're gonna click on this link. The instructions for this are all in the assignment, so you don't have to worry about, you know, you can stop paying attention if you want. But we're gonna do a git clone from this repo, okay? Okay, so what it did is it cloned that. Okay, so now I can actually get into, what does it say, GPU programming assignment here, okay. Okay, so now I'm in the programming assignment. And this is what you're gonna get from me. You're gonna get a fully, not fully functional, okay, but it'll compile and it'll kind of work for some inputs GPU program. And the application we're gonna implement for part one is vector max. So just like a sum where you have to kind of run over all the elements and add them all up, a vector max, you have to run over all the elements and figure out which one's the biggest. Very, very similar. It's almost identical, except with a little computational kernel. Okay, so let's go ahead and compile this. All we have to do to compile is type make. You're welcome to look at the make file, modify it, for your use cases, but this should work out of the box. And let me know if this stuff doesn't work. It's kind of meant, this is not meant to be the hard part. You should ask questions if you have problems with this part. Okay, so now we've compiled, and then we get our little executable here, vector max out. And I'm gonna run vector max, okay. Prints out a nice little usage. So I use vector max. Can you guys see this by the way? Here, I can. There we go. Okay, so we are going to type our vector length, then -k, and we're gonna pick which kernel we want to run. Okay, so as you kind of implement kernels, I want you to put them in specific locations in the code so that you can switch between them and run any one that you've ever developed. Okay, kind of going to do this incremental coding to evaluate. So I'm going to run 256 with kernel 1. Okay, so I'm doing finding the vector max of a randomly generated vector with a constant seed. So it's the same vector every single time for debugging purposes. And I'm going to run this. Oops, we don't have a GPU. Remember, we're in a dev node. We don't have GPUs. The GPUs are on the worker nodes. So what we have to do is we have to take this line, wrap it up in a little script, and then submit it. Okay, so we can compile on here, we can develop, but in order to get results, we have to run it on the cluster. Okay, and how we do that is we're using what's called a Slurm queuing system now in the department. It's kind of like PBS. If you've ever used PBS, it's basically the same thing, except it's open source and saves the department a lot of money. So let's look at our slurm.shell. Here, I'll just Emacs, I'll open it up. Okay. So this is a Slurm script. This is actually just copy and pasted from kind of the department template Slurm script. That's why there's all that information in there. You're welcome to kind of peruse it. Blah, blah, blah. And we get down to kind of the two most important things. This is if you submit it as a batch, where your standard error gets redirected to and where your output goes from standard out. Okay, so this is where your results are going to end up if you run this in batch mode. And then you can see here, like a little line of code down here. That's what's going to get run when we launch this job. Okay. So in order to launch this job, I'm going to type srun or sbatch. Okay. Equals GPU. So what I'm doing here is I'm actually requesting a node that has this resource, a GPU node. Okay, so I want to run this on the cluster, and I want a GPU node, and I want you to run slurm.shell. That's it. I click enter. Srun is actually going to redirect the standard out from that worker node to our dev node. So we're going to be able to see the results on the screen. And you can see that hit ran, we're timing the vector generation, and then we also have some kind of statistics about the kernel here. Okay. So the time it took again to transfer data to the GPU, right? Remember, we have this host device, we gotta allocate, we gotta send, and we gotta go over, we gotta compute, and then we gotta send stuff back. Okay, so we have the transfer to the GPU cost, we have the kernel execution time, and then the transfer from. Those are all added up in total, and then I just kind of totaled the kernel. You're welcome to modify this code. I'm not gonna look at these numbers. I am, however, going to look at the correctness. So this has built-in correctness checking capabilities. Okay. So everything worked correctly because it only gives an error when it doesn't work. So let's look at our Slurm script and let's say 256 is kind of a wimpy vector size. So let's go up a little bit. I'm going to double this to 512. Still pretty wimpy. Okay. Now I'm going to run this again. Okay, so we ran the same code, bigger vector size here, but one line changed, okay? Now our code failed. And what it says is it says, well, the GPU found this is the maximum value in the vector. This is the maximum single precision float. The CPU found this maximum. They differed, and so the GPU version must be wrong. So you can use this to kind of debug some of your code. Okay. Problem one is fixing that problem. I gave you a fully functional kernel. It's naive, it's slow, it's single-threaded on a massive barrel processor SIMD architecture, okay? But it works. So problem one is all about fixing the host code, remember, host device, fixing the CPU code in order to make this kernel work correctly. It's gonna involve kind of launching multiple kernels and doing that reduction. Okay, let's go look at the code just for a little bit. We have like 5 minutes left, so let's just kind of look at what this code looks like. Okay, so we have kind of all our four declarations. This is kind of just like very, very plain C style. I'm not doing anything complicated here. There's no object-oriented code, okay? This is the main program, prints the usage, blah, 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 does all the timing, okay? And then we get down here to our kernel. Okay, so this is kernel one. You can see we kind of have this global declaration here, and that means this is the GPU kernel. You can see I'm doing calculations on block dimensions and thread dimensions, right? The first thing you generally do in these kernels is like, where, what am I, and what block am I in, what's my name? And then you can see very, very, very early on, right? I mask all the other threads off. I'm only picking one thread out of this entire thread block, which is hard-coded to be 256 to do this computation. Okay. So again, this works. Don't touch this. Don't change this. This should stay the same. When you do start modifying the kernel, copy and paste another function here. Okay. And then what you can do is insert it down here in the proper location in this switch statement. So what I do is, you know, when you say dash K1 or dash K2, you're kind of selecting which function you want to run here. Okay. So again, don't modify the first kernel. Just kind of copy and paste and then make modifications to new kernels. Okay, that's kind of that's it. That's all I have.
Okay.
Did you want me to answer any other questions that I forgot?
So we'll say that part one you should have submitted by a week from next Tuesday. I'll put that on Colab. Will submissions via Colab be okay with you?
Yeah, that's fine.
I'll give you Colab access.
There may be some holes. I'll have to update the assignment with dates for submission and things like that. And we might have to talk a little bit more about what the format is. But this format has worked for me in the past. But.
And like before, this will be a checkpoint, so we'll just maybe look to see, does it look like you actually tried to do the whole thing, but you can feel free if you find something's wrong later, mm-hmm. correct it for the final submission.
Yeah.
And we'll only really grade the final submission as long as you tried it in the first submission. And for the...
Okay.
Yeah, we'll just see if the functions are implemented, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Actually, only the final one. For the final one, there's going to be the project part, which will be more open-ended. We'll provide some example serial code for that, which is not included now in the repo later on, but you can start out without it. And the final due date I have in the calendar the 28th of this month, so probably more, maybe the 29th, which would be Tuesday after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you're welcome to. Just beware, we are going to run them on these machines that we are guiding you to. So every once in a while, off by one errors that don't crop up on your machine, like do you have a CUDA card in your, so off by one errors that don't show up in that architecture might show up in the department architecture. Once you develop and get everything right, it's pretty easy to migrate to this style. But yeah, that will be easier. Also, if you don't have experience or that much experience with things like C or things like Linux, editing programs on Linux, right? You're gonna have to be kind of editing these programs and compiling them on the department servers. So those are skills you're gonna also have to learn too. Again, those aren't meant to be blockers for you. So if you've never done that before, it's gonna make this assignment a little harder. You're gonna wanna start earlier. Get experience with VI or Emacs, or rsync or some other way of kind of editing code on servers. So this is definitely a skill you should learn.
And if that's the part you're having trouble with, please do not hesitate to ask about it.
That's not.
It's not supposed to be a problem.
Right. Don't feel bad about
it. Yeah, you can probably find some workable solution for you.
Another caveat is. I actually don't know what the status of print debugging on GPUs is these days, but generally when you're doing this kind of host device accelerator computing, you have this added layer of obfuscation of what's going on, right? You can't say I want to print out this value. I'm kind of guilty. I do a lot of printf debugging in my code, okay? There are now fairly sophisticated programs to help you debug CUDA programs, even while running on the GPU. So if you're familiar with command line debugging like GDB, there's a CUDA GDB that you can use in interactive mode in order to kind of step through your program and figure out where it's going wrong. I highly recommend investing the time to get to know those tools because it will save you a lot of time on the back end. If you ever have problems debugging your code, you're welcome to kind of ask me for ideas, but I probably won't be willing to sit down and actually work through your bug with you. It's pretty standard. A lot of, the assignment is actually fairly easy. A lot of this is just startup. So get started early, ask a lot of questions. It's okay to feel stupid. We're throwing a lot at you at once here, so. Feel free to email me too. It's pretty easy to find who I am. Okay, anything else? Okay, thanks.